Imagine running a marathon, getting hit by a truck, and like fighting off the flu all at the exact same time.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Right. And now imagine your doctor looking at your blood work, checking all your scans, and telling you with complete, absolute confidence that you're perfectly healthy.
Which is just wild to even think about.
It really is. But for millions of people dealing with chronic multi-system illnesses, that paradox isn't just, a dramatic metaphor. It's basically a Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly. It's their daily life.
It's the defining, kind of isolating reality of conditions that our current medical system, well, it just simply doesn't know how to look at them.
Right, because there's this fundamental mismatch between the nature of the suffering and the actual tools we use to measure it. Like when someone is dealing with long COVID or chronic fatigue syndrome or, profound dysautonomia, the standard diagnostic machinery just falls silent.
It just doesn't pick anything up.
Right. And not because the physiology isn't screaming, but because our medical microphones are like tuned to the entirely wrong frequency.
Which perfectly brings us to the source material for today's deep dive. We are looking at this truly groundbreaking academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Saley.
It's a brilliant piece of work.
It really is. It's called Coherence Physiology, the Embodied Substrate of Life Coherent Medicine. And actually, as a fun little side note on modern research, Dr. Saley used ChatGPT as a research assistant to help synthesize everything.
Which honestly is becoming increasingly necessary. I mean, the scope of this paper is just massive.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's attempting to bridge disciplines that usually, they sit in totally separate buildings on a university campus, like biophysics and immunology.
So our mission today is to really explore this new framework for understanding the human body. Dr. Saley is proposing this massive shift away from the legacy sort of body as a machine model.
Right, the old mechanical view.
Exactly. And moving towards something he calls a living continuum. And we're going to dive into how this shift completely upends our view of chronic illness, healing, and, well, the fundamental biophysics of life.
It's a total paradigm shift.
It is. To kind of visualize the contrast here, think about how modern medicine currently operates, right? It treats the body like a city's power grid, but it focuses entirely on the isolated appliances.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. So if your toaster is smoking, you call a toaster specialist. If your fridge stops running, you call a refrigeration guy.
Naturally.
But if the entire city's voltage drops by 10%, neither the toaster guy nor the fridge guy is going to find a broken part in their specific appliance. They'll just tell you the appliance is fine.
Yeah, they'll say it looks normal.
Exactly. But the system is still failing.
And that captures the absolute essence of what Dr. Saithley calls medicine's explanatory architecture. The current architecture relies on what he terms the organ assemblage model.
Organ assemblage, like a collection of parts.
Exactly. It's the Cartesian legacy.
Yeah.
René Descartes gave us this incredible tool of reductionism breaking complex things into smaller, manageable pieces to understand them.
Right.
So medicine conceptually separated the body into distinct organs that are just sort of connected by transport tubes.
Which is, I mean, it's exactly how medical schools are structured to this day. You do a cardiology rotation, then neurology, then gastroenterology.
Precisely. And look, for acute, localized crises like a blocked coronary artery or a ruptured appendix, that model is basically miraculous.
Oh, for sure. It saves lives every day.
It absolutely does. But for chronic systemic illness, the organ assemblage model creates an absolute blind spot because in an assemblage, causality is always assumed to be linear and local.
Meaning A causes B.
Right. A virus attacks a cell or a gene mutates and it causes a localized disease. But coherence physiology argues that the body is not just an assemblage of parts wired together after the fact. It is a living continuum.
Okay, so in a continuum model, we aren't looking at linear causality. We're looking at something more distributed, like circular causality.
Exactly. Causality becomes state dependent. So imagine a minor disturbance, say abnormal blood flow dynamics in the microvessels because of like chronic
Okay,
immobility.
you're just not moving enough.
Right. That disturbed flow creates abnormal physical shear stress on the vessel walls. And the vessel walls respond by triggering a localized immune cascade.
So the immune system jumps in.
Yeah. And the immune cells demand a massive influx of energy. So they alter the local metabolic environment, literally stealing resources away from tissue repair.
Wow.
And without repair, the surrounding connective tissue becomes fibrotic and stiff. That stiff tissue then physically constricts the blood vessels even further, which just worsens the original abnormal flow.
Oh, I see. The disturbed flow amplifies the immune alarm, which drains the energy, which stiffens the tissue, which restricts the flow even more. The causality is a continuous loop.
Yes, exactly.
So if a patient is trapped in that loop, where is the disease? Like, is it a vascular issue? Is it an immune issue? A metabolic issue?
Well, to the specialist, it looks like four separate intractable problems. The rheumatologist sees the stiff tissue. The immunologist sees the inflammation.
Right.
But to the organism, to the body itself, it's a single, highly coordinated, self-sustaining state.
That makes so much sense. But let me push back just a little bit on this continuum idea. If we move away from the organ assemblage, what does that actually mean for the organs themselves?
That's a very fair question.
Because, I mean, a surgeon can certainly open up an abdomen and physically hold a liver. The boundary is right there. It feels incredibly tangible. So are we suggesting organs are just an illusion?
No, not an illusion at all, but rather local differentiations. The paper uses a really fantastic conceptual bridge here. Think of a whirlpool in a fast-moving river.
Okay, a whirlpool.
The whirlpool is absolutely real. You can point to it, you can measure its diameter, you can calculate its velocity, and it clearly has a boundary, right?
Yeah, you can see exactly where it is.
But you cannot extract the whirlpool from the river. Its entire existence is an expression of the river's continuous flow.
Oh, wow. I love that.
Yeah, if you try to put the whirlpool in a bucket to study it in a lab, you just have a bucket of dead water. Your liver, your heart, they are specialized, dense expressions of a continuous biological field.
You can't put the whirlpool in a bucket. That is such a perfect analogy. But if the body is this continuous river, this field, it has to be made of physical material.
Oh, absolutely.
We aren't talking about mystical energy here. We are talking about actual biophysics. So what is the actual physical substrate of this continuum?
Well, the foundation lies in what we actually used to dismiss as just the packing peanuts of the body, namely the fascia, the extracellular matrix, and the interstitium.
Packing peanuts, that's hilarious.
It's true. Historically, anatomists would literally scrape away the fascia to look at the important stuff, you know, the red muscle and the white bone.
Right, the stuff they thought actually did the work.
Exactly. But modern imaging and biophysics have revealed that fascia is this continuous three-dimensional web of collagen and connective tissue that permeates every single structure in the body, right down to the cellular level.
And it isn't just inert scaffolding, right? The collagen in this matrix has these fascinating physical properties. It's highly organized and it's piezoelectric.
Yes. The piezoelectric effect is absolutely crucial here. When you physically deform a crystalline structure, like collagen-like, when you stretch it or compress it, it actually generates an electrical charge.
So your physical movements are constantly generating electrical information throughout this whole web.
Exactly. And this entire web is bathed in a massive fluid compartment called the interstitium.
Right, which was essentially classified as a totally new organ just a few years ago, mainly because we finally developed imaging technology capable of seeing it in living tissue rather than just in dried out cadavers.
Precisely. When you look at living tissue, you see this massive interconnected network of fluid-filled spaces supported by collagen bundles.
Yeah.
This extracellular matrix, this ECM, it provides the immediate environment for every single cell in your body.
Wow.
And what's absolutely vital to understand is that the tissue holds physical memory.
Wait, really? Physical memory?
Yes. If you have an injury, the local collagen orientation actually changes. The tissue becomes stiffer. And even if the acute wound heals, that stiffened matrix continues to mechanically signal to the surrounding cells that there is an active threat in the area.
The tissue remembers the trauma physically. That's incredible. But we have to talk about the fluid inside that tissue, because this is where Dr. Sohili's paper introduces some genuinely frontier science.
Oh, yes. The interfacial water.
Right. Because we usually think of the water in our bodies as just bulk fluid. It's just the solvent, the stuff everything else kind of flits around in.
That's the classical view, for sure.
Yeah.
But the paper relies heavily on the thermodynamics of interfacial water.
Mm.
When water is crowded into these microscopic spaces, which it is in the human body, pressed tightly against collagen fibers and proteins, it doesn't act like the water in a glass.
This is the work of Dr. Gerald Pollack at the University of Washington, right? The whole concept of the exclusion zone, or EZ water.
Yes, exactly. And it's a massive paradigm shift in biophysics.
Yeah.
When water meets a hydrophilic or water-loving biological surface, it structures itself.
It changes shape.
Yeah, it forms a crystalline-like lattice. And in doing so, it literally excludes solutes, basically pushing out impurities. But more profoundly, this structuring process separates electrical charge.
Okay, I'm following.
The structure of water near the surface becomes negatively charged, and the bulk water beyond it becomes positively charged.
Wait, if the water is separating charge, it's essentially acting like a battery. But like thermodynamics tells us, you can't just create a battery out of nowhere. What is providing the energy to separate those charges and build that exclusion zone?
Radiant energy, specifically ambient infrared light, which is essentially just body heat.
Our own body heat.
Yes. Your own metabolic heat is absorbed by the water, providing the energy to build these structured charged zones. So the water in your connective tissue isn't just a passive solvent. It's a massive body-wide battery that stores energy and facilitates the transport of molecules.
That completely changes how we think about hydration and energy. But how does this physical web, the collagen, the matrix, the charged water, how does it actually communicate with the cells living inside it?
Because the cells need to know what's going on.
Right. Cells don't have eyes. They have to know what's happening outside to survive.
They know what's going on because they physically feel it. This is the domain of mechanobiology. Cells are literally covered in mechanoreceptors.
All right.
One of the primary classes of these are integrins. They're proteins that physically connect the scaffolding outside the cell to the cytoskeleton inside the cell and straight down into the nucleus where the DNA is stored.
So there is a continuous physical wire from like the collagen in your knee all the way through the cell membrane right down to the genome.
A literal physical connection. When the extracellular matrix is stretched or compressed, that mechanical force is transmitted straight through the integrins.
Wow.
It can literally physically pull open nuclear pores, changing which genes are expressed. Force is translated directly into biochemical information.
And this relies on the architectural principle of biotensegrity, doesn't it? Because our bodies aren't built like brick walls, where everything relies on heavy compression pushing down into a foundation.
Right. Brick walls are actually incredibly fragile if the ground shifts even a little.
Mm-hmm.
Biological systems use tensegrity, which is a balance of continuous tension and discontinuous compression.
Like a geodesic dome.
Exactly. Think of a geodesic dome, or those intricate wire and wood sculptures where the wood pieces never actually touch each other. They're just suspended by the tension of the wires.
The tension is shared across the whole system. If you pluck one wire, the whole structure instantly distributes the force.
Exactly. And within this tensegrity structure, you have fluids constantly flowing, blood and lymph. And the cells are exquisitely sensitive to the physical friction of this flow. This is what we call shear stress.
Let's talk about that shear stress, because I think it's the perfect bridge into how the body governs exchange. If you're sitting on a couch for 12 hours straight, your blood flow slows down, right? So the physical friction, the shear stress against the walls of your blood vessels drops. What does that mechanical silence tell your cells?
It tells them something is deeply, deeply wrong. Evolutionarily speaking, severe immobility implies a severe injury or impending death.
Oh, wow. So just sitting still feels like danger to the body.
Yes. The lack of healthy mechanical shear stress triggers the cells lining your blood vessels to shift away from producing healthy vasodilating molecules and toward producing inflammatory procoagulant molecules. The mechanical silence is literally interpreted as a biological threat.
Which brings us directly to the intelligence of the endothelium, the cells lining every single blood vessel in the body. We used to think of the endothelium as just like Teflon piping to keep the blood from leaking out into the muscles.
Oh, it's so much more than that. The endothelium is arguably the largest and most dynamic sensory organ in the entire body.
And the way it senses that shear stress is through this incredibly delicate microscopic structure called the glycocalyx.
Yes. The glycocalyx. Let's really try to visualize this. It's not just slime on the inside of the tube. It's a dense, negatively charged forest of sugar proteins sticking up into the bloodstream.
A forest, like a kelp forest anchored to the ocean floor, swaying in the current.
That's a brilliant image. As the blood flows past, it physically bends these microscopic sugar chains. And this physical bending acts like a lever.
Okay, so when they bend, what happens?
When the glycocalyx bends, it mechanically pops open ion channels on the cell surface, allowing calcium to flood into the endothelial cell.
Mm.
That calcium spike then triggers the production of nitric oxide.
And nitric oxide is the absolute master regulator of vascular health. It tells the blood vessels to dilate, it prevents platelets from sticking together, and it suppresses inflammation.
Exactly. But the glycocalyx is incredibly fragile. Things like high blood sugar, oxidative stress, or circulating viral proteins, they can literally shear the glycocalyx right off the cell wall.
Like a lawnmower cutting down the kelp forest.
Yes. And when that happens, the endothelium basically goes blind. It can no longer feel the blood flow. Nitric oxide production plummets. The vessels constrict, and inflammation skyrockets.
And this dysfunction doesn't just happen in the big arteries, right? The paper focuses intensely on the microcirculation, the massive network of microscopic capillaries.
Which is where the magic actually happens.
I think of the vascular system like a global supply chain. The big arteries, like the aorta or the femoral artery, are the interstate highways, but the microvessels are the last mile delivery trucks.
And the last mile is where all the actual exchange happens. The aorta doesn't feed any tissue directly, it's just transport. The capillaries are where oxygen actually crosses over to the hungry mitochondria.
So if your glycolysis is damaged and your microvessels constrict or get blocked by microclots, the last mile delivery fails.
Completely.
It absolutely doesn't matter if your heart is pumping perfectly and your lungs are full of oxygen. If the driveway to the cell is blocked, the tissue suffocates.
This phenomenon, microvascular dysfunction, is a cornerstone of coherence physiology. It explains the intractable brain fog in long COVID, the deep muscle pain in fibromyalgia, and even the specific visual and cognitive declines we see in aging.
Because the tissue is quite literally starving.
Exactly. The tissue is starving because the exchange intelligence has failed.
But the endothelium doesn't act alone, does it? It is constantly communicating with the boundary intelligence of the body, the cells that decide what is self, what is non-self, and what is dangerous.
Right, the immune sentinels.
And the absolute heavyweights here are the mast cells.
Mast cells suffer from a terrible PR problem in medicine, honestly. Mm. Most people only know them in the context of allergies. You know, you take an antihistamine to stop a runny nose.
Yeah, that's all I knew them for.
But mast cells are this ancient, highly sophisticated lineage of tissue-resident sentinels.
They are the body's border patrol.
Exactly. They don't circulate in the blood like other white blood cells do. They embed themselves at the frontiers. The skin, the respiratory tract, the gut lining.
The entry points.
Yes. But crucially, they also wrap themselves directly around blood vessels and sensory nerves deep within the tissues.
The neuroimmune synapse. This is where things get really wild. What exactly happens when a mast cell detects a threat? Let's trace the chemistry here.
Okay, so mast cells are packed with hundreds of granules containing incredibly potent chemical mediators. Histamine, tryptase, cytokines, chemokines.
A whole payload of chemicals.
Right. When the receptors bind to a pathogen or a toxin, or even when they are mechanically crushed by tissue trauma, they degranulate. They literally vomit these chemicals into the surrounding extracellular matrix.
And what do those specific chemicals actually do to the tissue?
Well, histamine immediately binds to receptors on the blood vessels, causing them to become highly permeable. They leak fluid into the tissue, which is exactly why an infected cut swells up.
Okay, that makes sense.
Meanwhile, mediators like tryptase and prostaglandins bind directly to the nociceptors, the pain-sensing nerve endings right next door. They lower the firing threshold of the nerve, making it hypersensitive to pain.
So the mast cell simultaneously commands the blood vessel to leak and the nerve to scream.
Yes.
Which is a perfect acute response if you, like, step on a rusty nail.
Yeah.
You want the area to swell up with immune cells and you want it to hurt so you stop walking on it.
It is brilliant, localized biological engineering. But the problem arises when the Border Patrol becomes paranoid. When the baseline of alarm is set so high that the mast cells begin degranulating in response to completely harmless stimuli.
This is exactly what we see in patients with environmentally triggered illnesses, right? Or conditions like mast cell activation syndrome, MCIS. The Border Patrol has just lost its mind.
Exactly.
A drop in barometric pressure, the smell of a synthetic perfume, a perfectly normal piece of food, or even like the neurochemicals released during a stressful email. All of these trigger the mast cells to dump their payload.
Because the mast cells are intimately wired to the nervous system and the vasculature, this isn't just a localized allergic reaction anymore. It becomes a systemic shock.
It affects everything.
Right. The leaking blood vessels drop your blood pressure, triggering orthostatic intolerance. You know, you stand up and feel like you're going to faint.
Ugh, awful.
The sensitized nerves send massive pain signals. The systemic inflammation crosses the blood-brain barrier, triggering profound neuroinflammation and cognitive dysfunction.
So you are experiencing a systemic biological invasion, but there is no actual invader. The sentinels are just shooting at ghosts.
And if the blood vessels are leaking, the microcirculation is shut down, and the nerves are screaming danger. How do the cells within that tissue survive?
They don't, do they? They pivot from survival to defense. And this is where we have to talk about the absolute core of cellular behavior, the mitochondria.
We really need to completely discard the old textbook definition of mitochondria as just the powerhouses of the cell.
RIP to my high school biology class.
I know, right? Yes, they produce ATP, the energy currency of the body, through oxidative phosphorylation. Mm-hmm. But their role is vastly more profound than that. They are the central environmental sensors and the executive regulators of cellular destiny.
Dr. Robert Navio's work on the cell danger response, or CDR, is the lens Dr. Saithali uses here, and it is a total paradigm shift.
The CDR framework reveals that mitochondria are constantly sampling the intercellular environment. They are measuring oxygen levels, pH, the presence of viral RNA, the concentration of heavy metals, and even the mechanical tension of the cell.
Wow, they're monitoring everything.
Everything. And when these parameters cross a certain threshold of danger, the mitochondria actively change their shape and their function.
They switch from peacetime energy production to wartime defense. How does that actually work mechanically?
Well, under healthy, safe conditions, mitochondria use oxygen to produce massive amounts of ATP to fund growth, repair, and complex tasks like deep thinking or running.
Peacetime operations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But when they sense a threat, they literally halt that process. They shift their metabolism toward glycolysis, which produces far less energy but allows them to rapidly generate reactive oxygen species-free radicals.
Wait, they are deliberately generating free radicals. We're always told free radicals are the ultimate enemy and we need to eat handfuls of blueberries to fight them.
In a peacetime state, yes, excessive free radicals cause aging and damage. But in a wartime state, those free radicals are chemical weapons. The mitochondria use them to destroy invading viruses or bacteria.
That's incredible.
They also stiffen the cell membrane to prevent pathogens from spreading. And they release signaling molecules to warn neighboring cells.
And one of those warning signals is actually ATP itself, isn't it? Which is incredibly counterintuitive to me.
It's a brilliant mechanism called purinergic signaling. Inside the cell, ATP is energy. But if a cell is damaged or breaks open, ATP spills out into the extracellular matrix.
And that's bad.
Very. When ATP is outside the cell, it binds to purinergic receptors on neighboring cells and acts as a massive danger signal. It's basically the biological equivalent of a fire alarm.
It tells every cell in the vicinity, one of our own just died violently. Prepare for an attack.
Yes. So when the mitochondria enter this cell danger response, they drastically cut the energy budget available for normal life. They hoard all the resources for defense.
Which fundamentally redefines the concept of fatigue. When a patient with a chronic multi-system illness says they are fatigued, doctors usually look for a lack of fuel, right? Like, are they anemic? Is their thyroid slow?
Okay.
But in the CDR framework, fatigue is not a passive running out of energy. It is an active, evolutionarily conserved state of energy resistance.
Like insulin resistance. You have the fuel in your bloodstream, but the cellular executive absolutely refuses to let you spend it.
Right. Think of mitochondria as the chief financial officers of your cells. In peacetime, they invest in growth and repair. But if they think a recession or a war is coming, they freeze all assets, halt production, and hoard cash.
That's a perfect analogy.
You feel exhausted because your cellular CFO just cut your budget to zero.
Because the mitochondria are looking at the threat signals. The mast cell histamine, the lack of oxygen from the broken microcirculation, the stiffened extracellular matrix, and deciding that it is fundamentally unsafe to spend energy on anything other than immediate survival.
It's a calculated choice.
Yes. They won't let you run, they won't let you digest food efficiently, and they won't let you concentrate, because those are luxury functions in a time of war.
And what's absolutely staggering here is the crossover with psychology. The neuroendocrine system translates psychosocial stress-like profound isolation, trauma, or even chronic financial anxiety into actual chemical signals.
It does.
And the mitochondria do not distinguish between the chemical signal of a virus and the chemical signal of severe social threat.
No. To a mitochondrion, a threat to survival is a threat to survival. If the brain's amygdala is screaming that the environment is unsafe, the neuroendocrine system floods the body with cortisol and catecholamines.
And the cells react the same way.
Exactly. The mitochondria receive those signals and execute the exact same cell danger response they would use for a physical infection. The artificial divide between biological and psychological illness completely dissolves at the mitochondrial level.
So an acute cell danger response is highly adaptive. You get the flu, your cellular budget is frozen, you feel terrible, you lie in bed for 5 days, the virus is eradicated, the fire alarm is turned off, and the mitochondria go back to peacetime production.
No, that's the healthy cycle.
But what happens when the alarm never shuts off?
That brings us to the conceptual climax of the paper. Defensive lock-in. This is the physiological reality of chronic illness.
Defensive lock-in. This is where all the isolated mechanisms we've discussed, the stiff fascia, the blocked microcirculation, the paranoid mast cells, the wartime mitochondria, they all become mutually entangled. They form a self-stabilizing trap.
Exactly. The system becomes perfectly organized around defense, but completely incapable of healing. The original trigger, whether it's a viral infection like Epstein-Barr or SARS-CoV-2, an exposure to mold, or a severe physical trauma, might be completely eliminated. The pathogen is long gone. But the biological field remains frozen in the geometry of threat.
Let's trace the specific physiology of this trap, because it's the exact loop that millions of patients are currently caught in.
Okay, let's do it. Imagine a patient who had a severe viral infection. The virus triggers the initial mast cell degranulation and mitochondrial cell danger response. As part of the immune response, the extracellular matrix becomes inflamed and the collagen stiffens.
And because the matrix is stiff, the normal mechanical cues, that biotensegrity and shear stress we talked about earlier, those are altered.
Right. This mechanical silence degrades the glycocalyx inside the blood vessels. The microcirculation clamps down. Hypoxia, meaning low oxygen, sets in.
The localized hypoxia causes the tissue to become slightly acidic. And what thrives in an acidic hypoxic environment? More mast cell degranulation.
Exactly. The mast cells dump more histamine and tryptase. The sensory nerves are bathed in this inflammatory soup, so they send constant pain and danger signals up the vagus nerve straight to the brain.
And the brain registers the danger and keeps the autonomic nervous system locked in sympathetic overdrive, the classic fight-or-flight state.
And because you're in fight-or-flight, your heart rate variability plummets, your digestion basically halts, and crucially, you cannot access deep, restorative sleep.
And without deep sleep, your brain cannot activate the glymphatic system to wash away metabolic waste.
Right, which means systemic oxidative stress increases.
And that provides the exact chemical signal the mitochondria need to maintain the cell danger response.
Yes, the mitochondria refuse to produce ATP, leading to profound, crushing fatigue.
The loop is completely sealed. The stiff fascia, the collapsed capillaries, the screaming nerves, the paranoid mast cells, and the striking mitochondria, they're all just constantly reinforcing each other.
They are. And this specific interconnected loop explains the most baffling symptom of chronic illness, post-exertional malaise, or PEM.
PEM is the absolute hallmark of conditions like ME/CFS and long COVID. A patient can feel relatively okay, they go for a short 15-minute walk, and 24 hours later, they are completely bedbound, paralyzed by fatigue, muscle pain, and flu-like symptoms.
Yeah, and standard medicine looks at that and says, well, exercise is good for you, you must just be deconditioned.
Which is a catastrophic misunderstanding of the physiology. Because in a healthy body, exercise creates a microstress. The mitochondria sense the demand, they briefly dip into stress, and then they overcompensate by building more mitochondria. It builds resilience.
But in defensive lock-in, the mitochondria are already at their absolute limits of stress tolerance. They are trapped in energy resistance.
So when you force them to expend energy on a walk,
they don't see it as a healthy challenge at all. They interpret the sudden energy drain as a massive breach of the defense perimeter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it triggers an immediate catastrophic amplification of the cell danger response. The system shuts down entirely to prevent what it perceives as impending death. The resulting crash is a severe metabolic crisis.
If you are listening to this right now and you have spent years being told your chronic pain or fatigue is a mystery, or worse, that it's all in your head, this framework is your absolute vindication.
It really is.
Your symptoms are not random failures. They are not psychological weakness. They are the manifestations of a highly intelligent, evolutionarily conserved defense program that has simply lost its way home.
That's a beautiful way to phrase it.
Your body is executing a coordinated survival strategy. It is just executing it out of context.
It shifts the entire philosophical approach to the patient.
Mm-hmm.
The body isn't broken in the way a machine breaks. It is locked in a state of high alert adaptation.
Which begs the most important question of all. If we are trapped in defensive lock-in, how do we get out? How do we convince the entire biological field that it is safe to stand down?
This is the domain of cellogenesis. If pathogenesis is the origin of disease, cellogenesis is the origin of health. It is the active biological restoration of the conditions necessary for adaptive self-repair.
Cellogenesis is not a passive event. It isn't just, you know, waiting to get better. And the paper is incredibly strict about this. Cellogenesis is not simply suppressing symptoms with pharmacology.
No. Blocking a pathway is not restoring a field. you can prescribe a massive dose of steroids to forcefully suppress the mast cells, or an amphetamine to artificially stimulate the nervous system.
Right, which people do.
And look, sometimes acute pathway suppression is necessary just to keep a patient alive or functioning, but it does not pick the lock.
To use a farming analogy, symptom suppression is like spraying green paint on a wilting crop and calling it healthy.
Perfect analogy.
Cellogenesis is testing the soil pH, checking the irrigation lines, and mapping the root systems. It is field restoration.
To restore the field, you have to systematically dismantle the defensive loop. You have to rehydrate the fascia and restore mechanical glide, perhaps through specific myofascial therapies.
You have to restore microvascular flow and repair the glycocalyx.
Yes. You have to regulate the autonomic nervous system to coax the body out of fight or flight, often using vagus nerve stimulation or specialized breathing protocols.
You have to restore the boundaries. Remove the environmental triggers, like mold, specific dietary antigens, volatile organic compounds that keep the mast cells agitated.
And crucially, you have to respect the mitochondrial energy envelope.
Uh-huh.
The paper highlights pacing as a fundamental biological necessity, not just a casual lifestyle tip.
Pacing your energy. If your cellular CFO has limited your budget to $10 of ATP a day, and you try to push through the fatigue and spend 15, you trigger the alarm.
Right.
To achieve cellogenesis, you have to consistently spend only $8. You have to show the mitochondria day after day that there is a surplus, that safety has returned.
And you must protect sleep at all costs. Sleep is described in the paper as a physiological commons. It is the non-negotiable state where the brain clears neurotoxins, the immune system recalibrates, and the mitochondria physically rebuild themselves.
This all sounds so incredibly rational and biologically sound, which leads to a massive glaring contradiction in my mind.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
If coherence physiology explains the mechanisms of chronic illness so elegantly, and if field restoration is the obvious solution, why is this so hard to find in a normal doctor's office? Why are patients spending decades and their life savings trying to piece this together on their own?
This is perhaps the most profound systemic critique in Dr. Saheeli's paper. He dives into the political economy of medical knowledge, exploring a concept called epistemic closure.
Epistemic closure. So the boundaries of what a system is willing or able to know.
Exactly. Modern evidence-based medicine is almost entirely built on the architecture of the randomized controlled trial, the RCT. The RCT is the gold standard for proving that a medical intervention works.
Sure.
But the RCT was specifically designed to test single variables.
Right. You take 1,000 people, you give 500 of them drug X to block receptor Y, you give 500 a placebo, and you see if a single symptom improves.
It is brilliant for testing the efficacy of a targeted acute intervention, like a new antibiotic or a statin. But it is philosophically and mathematically incapable of testing a complex, highly individualized, multivariable systems biology intervention.
Because cellogenesis requires doing 10 things at once. You're changing the diet, pacing the energy, doing fascial work, improving the sleep architecture, and regulating the nervous system. You can't put that in a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial.
You can't. And because you can't test it through the accepted architecture, the medical establishment often dismisses it as unproven or unscientific. The system's epistemology, its way of validating knowledge, creates a closed loop that literally excludes systems-level healing.
And let's be brutally honest about the economics here, too. Epistemic closure is heavily driven by monetization.
Absolutely. The pharmaceutical industry requires single, novel molecules that can be patented. You can patent a specific monoclonal antibody that blocks a specific inflammatory cytokine that generates billions of dollars.
But you cannot patent optimizing the extracellular matrix or restoring vagal tone.
Exactly. Furthermore, the insurance billing system is built entirely on the organ assemblage model.
Right. Doctors are given, what, 15 minutes to match a specific localized symptom to an ICD-10 billing code and then prescribe the matching FDA-approved standard of care.
The structural constraints of modern medicine, the 15-minute appointment, the single-variable RCT, the patent-driven pharmaceutical model, the localized billing codes, they make the practice of life-coherent medicine nearly impossible within standard institutions.
And this isn't just an administrative problem. It has devastating physiological consequences for the patient. The paper brings up Johann Galtung's concept of structural violence.
Yes. Structural violence occurs when social structures or institutions harm people by systematically preventing them from meeting their basic needs. In the context of chronic illness, the medical system itself often becomes a vector of structural violence.
When a patient with a complex multi-system illness goes to a doctor and their standard blood panels look fine, what usually happens? They are met with skepticism. They are told their symptoms are psychosomatic. They are essentially gaslit by the institution they came to for safety.
And we must return to the biophysics here. When a patient experiences medical gaslighting, they experience profound social threat and isolation.
And as we established, the neuroendocrine system translates social threat directly into a biological danger signal.
The mitochondria don't know the difference between a virus and a dismissive doctor.
Wow. The structural violence of the medical encounter literally deepens the patient's defensive lock-in. The disbelief actively worsens their cellular metabolism.
Precisely. Conversely, this means that deep empathetic listening, believing the patient, and validating their physiological reality is not just good bedside manner. It is the very first biological intervention in salogenesis.
Validation is a mechanism of action.
It is.
It signals the nervous system that the organism is no longer fighting alone, which begins the process of downregulating the cell danger response. That is incredibly powerful.
It demands a complete reimagining of the clinical encounter. The physician is not an auto mechanic looking for the broken part. The physician is a co-regulator, helping to map the defensive labyrinth and establish the conditions for safety.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today in this deep dive. We started by dismantling the organ assemblage and revealing the body as a continuous, dynamic living field.
We did.
We explored the piezoelectric fascia, the structured exclusion zones of interfacial water, and how our cells read the mechanical friction of our own blood flow. We mapped the breakdown of the microcirculation and the panic of the mast cell border patrol.
We saw how the mitochondria act as executive sensors, freezing the energy budget and initiating the cell danger response, ultimately trapping the body in the self-stabilizing loop of defensive lock-in.
And we examined the absolute necessity of salogenesis field restoration while confronting the immense structural and economic barriers that keep this knowledge locked out of mainstream clinical practice.
It really provides a vocabulary for the invisible suffering of millions of people.
It does. Which leaves us with one final, deeply important consideration. Everything we've talked about today, the mast cells, the mitochondria, the vagus nerve, they are all exquisitely tuned environmental sensors.
Right.
They are constantly asking one question, am I safe? If coherence physiology is accurate, we have to look very closely at the environment we are forcing our biology to inhabit.
It brings the concept of prevention into a radically new light.
Look at the baseline of modern human existence. We are constantly bathed in artificial blue light late into the night, which disrupts our neuroendocrine rhythms. We are consuming highly processed, hyperpalatable food-like substances that shred our gut linings.
We are exposed to tens of thousands of novel industrial chemicals and microplastics that our evolutionary sentinels have literally never seen before.
We sit immobile in chairs for 10 hours a day, depriving our fascial web of the mechanical forces it needs to signal health. And we are constantly plugged into a digital news cycle that floods our brains with notifications of global crises.
Keeping our sympathetic nervous systems in a permanent state of low-grade terror.
Every single one of those factors is read by the cellular intelligence as a threat to survival.
Every single one.
Are we inadvertently building a society that acts as a continuous, unavoidable danger signal? Are we engineering an environment that forces our bodies into a permanent state of defensive lock-in just to survive the modern day?
It's a sobering thought.
Our biology is doing exactly what it was designed to do. It is the environment that has become fundamentally incoherent with life.
It suggests that true healing and true prevention requires more than just personal biological optimization. It requires a profound reassessment of how we actually live.
So if you are listening to this, what is the signal you are sending to your continuum right now? Because remember, you are not a machine waiting to be fixed. You are a vast, incredibly intelligent, living ecosystem.
Absolutely.
And navigating the murky waters of health begins with a single step. What small, tangible change can you make today? Whether it's getting sunlight in your eyes in the morning, taking 5 deep diaphragmatic breaths to stretch your fascia, or simply validating your own physiological reality to finally signal to yourself that it is safe to stand down.